Hi, I'm Yusuf Zine. My latest TVO Today podcast is on how a Canadian ends up in a Chinese prison and if he's even alive. Listen and subscribe to Extradition. Available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
It won't be long now before I give away a free copy of my latest book, John Turner, an intimate biography of Canada's 17th Prime Minister. We're having a draw among those of you who have left us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts and then sent us an email with a screenshot of it. We'll announce the winner at the end of June, so get those reviews in. Welcome, everyone, to the On Poly podcast. I'm Steve Paikin.
And I'm John Michael McGrath.
Today on the pod, last week, smoke engulfed huge parts of our province, forcing many indoors. The Premier's response to the event is raising some eyebrows.
The former Governor General, now Special Rapporteur on Foreign Interference in Our Democracy, may be stepping aside, but the story continues to have reverberations around Queen's Park.
Just 2 weeks to go in the race for mayor in Ontario's capital city, we'll check the state of play and why the polls are saying such different things.
And in your column, my column, I look at what Yasser Naqvi says the Liberals got wrong in government and what we can learn from that.
And my column focuses on one of the great all-time political leadership conventions that happened 40 years ago last weekend and just happened to be the first one I ever covered.
It's June 13th, 2023, so let's get to it.
Speaking of firsts.
Yes, sir.
What did you do on this date 10 years ago?
This happens, as we record this, happens to be my 10th anniversary of becoming a Queen's Park reporter.
There you go. So you walked into the building, not for the first time.
No.
But for the first time as a reporter.
Yes.
10 years ago today.
Yes. As we've mentioned before on the podcast, my father was also a Queen's Park reporter, and I would periodically, as an adolescent, go visit him at his office. So I had been to Queen's Park many, many times before becoming a reporter. But yes, this week is 10 years as a Queen's Park reporter. A lot longer than I thought I would make it, actually.
Do you know how I know that?
And how do you know that, sir?
Your dad sent me a copy of your tweet, just in case I missed it, which I did, because I don't want to spend that much time on Twitter anymore. But he sent me a copy of your tweet, so I knew about
and,
this.
And he said, bug him about this on the podcast?
No, he didn't say a thing. He just passed it along for information, and I've chosen to bug you about it of my own volition. And I think it's a beautiful thing. Do you remember anything about that day?
I do, actually, because I was late. I was supposed to start a few days before, and my wife and I were on a vacation, and our plane got delayed. And so I showed up at Queen's Park the day after the legislature rose for the summer. And so I had missed my one opportunity as a rookie to actually speak to MPPs. The halls were basically empty. It was the start of the summer break. And so anyway.
There you go. But it was memorable for not that reason, but for other reasons.
Yes, for other reasons.
Gotcha. Well, you will remember. Happy anniversary. Anyway,
thank you. While we're talking anniversaries, a happy belated birthday.
Yeah, there's that too. You stop counting, or at least you don't want to be reminded of that necessarily when you get where I am in life, but it's okay. Getting through another year is a good thing. Well, you remember last week, JMM, I told you about some people who'd approached me in Sudbury to talk about how much they enjoyed the podcast. Well, guess what? It happened again. This time in Ottawa, I'm at the airport about to fly home, and a fella named Alexandre Matt stopped me to say that he too was a fan. And boy, my spidey senses are tingling here because I just want to check. You're not setting these things up just to make me feel better, are you?
This has actually been my long game for the last 10 years. I've just been peppering these people all over the province.
I somehow think that as accomplished as you are, you probably can't pull that off. I think Matthew O'Meara just whispered in my ear that Alexandre sent a picture. He took a selfie of the two of us at the airport in Ottawa and sent it in. So, Alexandre, if you're listening again, and j'espère que that you are, that's how good my French is. Anyway, glad to have you aboard, and away we go. Let's get to the mailbag, because we do enjoy getting your feedback at onpolitics@tvo.org. JMM, what's up this week?
We've got a question from listener Mike, responding to our conversation last week about Yasser Naqvi's entry into the Ontario Liberal leadership race. Mike asks, do you think there's any chance the OLP leadership can turn into a meaningful debate about the party's role in our democracy and our society, or am I naive for hoping so? We're also going to mention that we did read your whole email, Mike. You acknowledged in the email, it's probably too long to read the whole thing on the pod.
we're going to do what Peter Mansbridge always says that he does on his podcast, which is to say, yes, we do read the entire email, but we don't necessarily read the whole thing out loud on the podcast because it's a half-hour show, you know? Anyway, to Mike's point, the answer is absolutely, of course, Mike. That is, frankly, what every leadership convention is about. It's just not about who's going to be the leader, but it's also, what are we going to stand for? Are we going to be a Sunny Ways type of party or let me be your voice of vengeance type of party? Where are we going to be on the political spectrum? Do we want to compete with New Democrats and Greens to be the most progressive voice out there? Or do we want to compete with disaffected progressive conservatives and centrist independents more in the middle? These are the great questions around the party and its place in our democracy. So no, Mike, I don't think you're being naive at all. This is what it's all about.
And we're already seeing some of that happen. You know, Bonnie Crombie saying, you know, that she thought that the party could even govern from the center right. We have Nader Erskine-Smith talking about, you know, wanting the liberals to remain more on the progressive side of the political spectrum. Yasser Naqvi acknowledging mistakes from the past and perhaps looking to go in a different direction now. And I also want to add that Nate Erskine-Smith and Ted Hsu both released substantial housing platforms this week. So, you know, it's not just talking about the philosophy of the party, but real sort of meat and potatoes, policy wonk stuff that happens in these leadership races as well. You know, it is all going to come out over the next several months, the next 6 months almost, culminating with a vote in December. Again, if you'd like to ask about content on the show or really, you know, anything, please email us at onpolitics@tvo.org. Now on to issue one.
It is not often that we talk about the weather on this podcast, but if you stepped outside at any point this past week, it smelled like you were next to a campfire. That smell is from the more than 440 wildfires engulfing much of Canada and parts of the northeastern United States in harmful smoke. The majority of the fires are in Quebec, but there are 64 active fires in the northeast and northwest parts of the province of Ontario. Premier Doug Ford and opposition leader Marit Stiles got into it during question period last week.
Speaker, yesterday, the Minister of Natural Resources and Forestry refused to acknowledge a connection between the climate crisis and these forest fires. Will the Premier show some leadership today and act on the climate emergency?
Premier.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I'm actually in shock that the Leader of Opposition is politicizing wildfires. It's staggering, really.
Things got a little more heated, pardon the pun, the following day when the Premier was trying to use the last spring sitting day to extol his government's record.
Mr. Speaker, I have an opportunity to speak to governors and ambassadors all over the world. They're saying, what are you doing in Ontario? You're on fire. You're leading the world.
You can hear it from the opposition benches in that clip, but more than a few people took issue with the Premier's choice of words.
There. Yeah, let's do a little fact check here, because it is the case that careless campers and lightning strikes do account for some of the wildfires burning these days. But environmentalists would also like it put on the record that a warming planet due to climate change is also part of the problem here. As a result, we saw people last week wearing masks outdoors, not because of COVID-19, but rather because of too much smoke in the air.
Yeah, I mean, I was one of those people when I biked to TVO last week. I figured if I was going to do the cardio of biking in Toronto, I probably should be wearing a mask. So far, the Premier has avoided making a link between the wildfires and the climate crisis. We can also remind our listeners that the current government canceled 750 renewable energy contracts in 2019. And as a result, the province is going to have to burn fossil fuels such as natural gas more in the years to come until the province's nuclear fleet has been totally refurbished and in fact, probably expanded thanks to some choices this government has made. You know, I know the Premier, in fact, believes that his party has a good story to tell on the environment, but a bigger look at these issues may suggest not so much.
Yeah, I think critics are pointing to those renewable energy contract cancellations as one of the worst decisions that this government has made so far, and the longer the time goes on, the worse and worse it looks. One other detail I'm sure our listeners are interested in is the outcry over the Ontario forest fire fighting budget and a cut in 2019. Marit Stiles tweeting about the cut, saying, "We won't forget that Doug Ford's Conservatives cut 67% from the Ontario emergency forest firefighting budget and are fighting to reverse them." But the Natural Resources Minister, Graydon Smith, says Ontario can spend more to combat the flames. So what's the deal here?
So the amount of money we spend on fighting forest fires depends on how many forest fires there are, right? In 2021, it was a pretty bad fire season, and we spent $237 million. 2022 was a milder fire year, and the budgeted expenditure was $100 million. And the government's plan for this year, in 2023, was $135 million. So obviously, those numbers are a lot less than $237 million. But when Minister Smith says the government can spend more, what he's saying is that if it in fact turns out to be another bad fire season, and obviously it hasn't started well, then the government can spend more than it has budgeted.
We've talked a lot about contingency funds on the podcast before, and this is sort of a classic example, I guess.
It is. And it's worth adding, however, that OPSU has argued it's not as just as simple as contingency spending. The union, this is the union that represents many Ontario public sector workers, including firefighters, they argue that the province is just objectively short-staffed when it comes to fire crews. And, you know, this is a pretty common problem for this government, all governments, but this one as well. In much the same way that a hospital bed without a nurse is just furniture, you do actually need firefighters you can call on when the fire season comes around, or you end up calling on your friends for help. But we would normally call on fire crews from Quebec to help us out, but the ones in Quebec are pretty busy now,
They're
too.
They're kind of busy. Yes, they are. Well, let's do one more thing on this issue, because the Energy Minister, Todd Smith, made an announcement in Trenton on Monday of this week, and it is related to climate change. Smith announcing that all 20 en route stations, that's ON route, right? Ontario, en route stations along Highway 401 now have electric vehicle charging stations attached. At least two in every station and more in others. The Ivy, and that's spelled IVY, the Ivy Charging Network is responsible for the stations. Now, there are apparently 113,000 electric vehicles in Ontario today. They estimate by the year 2030, one out of every three vehicles sold in Ontario will be electric. And, you know, as a guy who drives an EV, I hear this term all the time, range anxiety. One of the reasons people are hesitant to buy EVs is that they're not sure that they can actually get to where they got to get to on one charge. So obviously, these charging stations all along the 401 are designed to ease the range anxiety that drivers may feel and promote the sale of EVs in the years ahead. Okay, JMM, what'd you make of the announcement?
Well, you mentioned earlier that you know, the government does have stories it can tell on climate policy if it chooses to. It doesn't actually have to avoid even using the words climate like it sometimes seems to. This is one of those stories, right? They are, let's say, belatedly getting enthusiastic about electric vehicles. They did pull electric chargers out of GO stations early in their tenure. They are now putting them back in en route stations. There's a whole subplot that I am not going to get into right now about why it has taken so long, and it involves public-private partnership arrangements and that kind of thing. But, you know, this is a good milestone for the province to hit. I do want to note that there is no taxpayer dollar commitment behind this. The Ivy Network is run in part by OPG, the provincial power utility. They did actually receive some federal funding for this expansion, but as I understand it, no provincial tax dollars have gone to it. That said, you know, it's good news for EV drivers, or at least for some EV drivers.
Why just some?
Well, the Ivy Network so far uses two types of chargers for its fast charging stations. For the EV nerds out there, it's the CCS and the CHAdeMO plugs. The best-selling EV in Canada is the Tesla Model 3, which does not use either of those chargers. Tesla models use their own type of plug. So Tesla drivers are unaffected by this news. That's okay, though, because Tesla is widely regarded as having the most reliable charger network anyway, even before this announcement. So much so that in recent weeks, GM and Ford announced they were actually ditching the CCS plug that Ivy is using, and those automakers are now moving to Tesla's model plug.
So you're saying that just as Ontario is finally getting the en route stations wired up for EVs, the car industry is moving from Betamax to VHS?
In practice, it might not be that bad. People can already buy adapter plugs in some cases, but I certainly couldn't help but note the timing. Now on to issue two.
Last week was a very tough one for former Governor General David Johnston, who, as we know, accepted the assignment as special rapporteur on the issue of foreign interference in our elections and our democracy. Johnston had some previous social connections to both Prime Minister Trudeau personally and some professional advisory connections to the Pierre Trudeau Foundation, although he took pains to say he wasn't on the board and he wasn't in a position of decision-making. Nevertheless, Johnston has rethought the usefulness of his role and has acknowledged his attempt to bring added trust to public institutions has in fact had the opposite effect, and so he stepped down. But the story has had some reverberations with one current MP, who's a former Queen's Park MPP, and a current member of the Ontario Legislature, who was turfed from the Progressive Conservative Caucus because of this whole foreign interference story. Okay, JMM, pick up the story there if you would.
The first politician you referred to is Han Dong, former MPP for Trinity Spadina, now MP for Don Valley North. He was named in reporting by Global News as someone who had connections with consular officials in Beijing's consulate in Toronto. There's nothing illegal about that, but news reports allege that Dong had said to Chinese government officials that they should continue to detain the two Michaels to benefit the Liberal Party. One of the few, I think, really cut and dry conclusions that Johnson did make in his report before resigning was to say that this was categorically false. Dong had actually filed a defamation suit against Global News earlier this year. The second politician you're referring to is Vincent Ke, who represents the same Don Valley North riding provincially that Dong represents federally. Global News reported that Ke served as an intermediary between the Chinese government and candidates it wanted to financially support. Ke resigned from the PC caucus after that report was published and currently sits as an independent. Johnson found that there was some intelligence to suggest that the Chinese government wanted to distribute money, but there was no clear evidence as to whether that ever actually happened. Last week, Ke announced that, like Dong, he has filed a statement of claim against Global News, and he is in part relying on Johnson's finding to argue that Global's conduct is defamatory and false. As we are recording this, Global News has not retracted any of its stories and says it stands by its reporting. MPP Ke and MP Dong both still sit as independent members of their respective legislatures, and it is currently not clear when that will change, though both Premier Ford and Prime Minister Trudeau have at least floated the possibility that they might re-enter their respective caucuses.
If cleared.
If cleared, yes.
Right. Okay, on to issue three. We're less than 2 weeks to go before probably a very small percentage of Torontonians go to the polls and choose a new mayor to replace John Tory, who resigned back in February. In pretty much every poll that's been taken to date, former MP Olivia Chow has a sizable lead over everyone else in the race. But there is one polling company which has consistently showed former city councillor Annabai Lau in a strong second place and now nipping at the heels of Chow.
We're going to tread carefully here as we outline the facts here because, you know, we're not alleging malfeasance here and we don't want to get sued. But, you know, the fact is one polling company, Main Street Research, has consistently showed Bai Lau with a higher degree of support than any of the other pollsters who have been polling this race. It's unusual because of the nature of the race that with so many candidates vying for second place, even small changes in position can look more important than they actually are. But Main Street Research has consistently put Bai Lau well ahead of what other polls have showed, as we say, consistently put her in second place. Meanwhile, Forum Research and Liaison Strategies both have Bai Lau in fifth place in their most recent polls. Now, you and I are not pollsters, and, you know, I've spoken with people on other campaigns who have said, you know, like, it's possible that Main Street is simply seeing something that other pollsters are not. But the disparity is noticeable, and it has been noticed.
Now, again, we're not alleging anything, but I can say that several mayoral candidates have spoken to me about this and find it passing strange that Bai Lau is back with the rest of the pack in all the other polls, but is a strong second in Main Street's polling. I don't know what to make of that, but clearly the other candidates find it passing strange.
Passing strange is a good phrase. What we can say with factual certainty is this. You know, Bai Lau has had a very good campaign by many metrics. She's got the most endorsements from other Toronto city councillors by far. She's got the endorsement of two former mayors. She's got major endorsements from organized labor, including the Liuna Construction Labor Union and the city's two largest public sector unions, QP Locals 416 and 79. 1989. You know, she's run this campaign with a lot of energy. It has a mix of liberal and conservative supporters behind her. It's the kind of thing that would normally be a recipe for a very potent bid.
All true. But for some reason, the polls have just not moved much at all, with some notable exceptions. Anthony Fury, the Toronto Sun columnist, has seen his support increase significantly, but he's still well back of Chow. And I'd also observe that Chow's numbers are so high for two reasons. Number one, great name recognition. She's 66 years old. She's been around Toronto politics for 30 years, having been elected to city council before she was an MP. This was in 1992, right? 31 years ago. She's been around. She's former NDP leader Jack Layton's widow, and people remember that too. However, ask all neutral observers about this race, and to a person, they will say she has run the most lackluster, uninspiring campaign, a classic front-runner's campaign where she's tried to avoid doing much at the risk of seeing her numbers drop. But, and this is important, she has a lane all to herself. What do I mean by that? Political strategists often talk about candidates either having a lane to themselves or having to share a lane with others. Chow is the only openly New Democrat in the race. So if you're an NDP supporter, she's your only choice. And she has that lane all to herself. Conversely, Josh Matlow, Anna Bailao, Mitzi Hunter, they're all sharing the small L Liberal lane. So that vote is split three ways. And over in the Conservative lane, former Police Chief Mark Saunders and Anthony Fury are sharing that lane, again splitting the center-right vote. And candidates Bailao and Brad Bradford also occasionally straddle that center-right lane, making the vote even more fractured. So, Chow having her own lane all to herself is an enormous tactical advantage. One more thing. Back in the day, JMM, back in the day, some powerful backroom types would say, okay, all you other candidates, look, if we're going to stop Olivia Chow, you all can't run because you're all splitting the anti-Chow vote. So you, I'm sorry, but you have to drop out. And you're going to be the champion, you, this other candidate, you're going to be the champion of the anti-Chow forces, and everybody else is going to get in line and enjoy it. And amazingly, that would happen. There were people who could do that. That is not happening this time, and therefore no one has dropped out. There's probably only one person who could do it, and my hunch is no one's going to listen to him if he tries it.
If that person is Premier Doug Ford, I suspect you're right. He is desperate to have Chow lose and to have Saunders win. I think he hasn't quite gotten so far as to name Saunders literally, but he has made it very, very clear. He has no real currency with Matlow, Bailao, Hunter, or Bradford to make that happen. And so barring some kind of catastrophic case of Chow's vote simply not coming out or other candidates on their own deciding to drop out, Chow is almost certainly going to win. There is one other person I can think of who might be able to shape the race at least a little, though, and that's John Tory. The ex-mayor has been silent about who should succeed him in this race, and I think any of the candidates would tell you it might actually be a bit of a mixed blessing to get his endorsement, but it's just about the last thing I could think of that might shake up this race. If he were to come out and, for example, say, you know, if you supported me and you liked the direction the city was going with me in the mayor's seat, well, here's the person who you should throw your vote behind.
I totally cannot imagine him doing that right now. I won't say it's impossible, but I cannot imagine him doing it right now.
I think if it were going to happen, it might have already happened by now. And I suspect he has stayed quiet deliberately and will continue to do so.
And we do have to remember, Mark Saunders, the former police chief, this is not his first run in elective politics. He ran for Doug Ford in the last provincial election. So, yes, the two of them are simpatico ideologically. And in fact, I was at an event recently, JMM, and there was a current member of Toronto City Council who came up to me and said, you know what, I just spoke to the premier and he said to me, do everything you possibly can to defeat Chow. So it's unmistakable where the premier's loyalties lie in this one. Now, let's state the obvious here. There are still almost 2 weeks to go in the mayoralty election campaign. A lot of people are only starting to pay attention now, and others will not start paying attention until the last few days. So it is true that anything could still happen, but obviously things look pretty baked in at this juncture. One more observation, if I may. Ever since John Tory stepped down, Jennifer McKelvey has assumed the role of mayor on an interim basis and by all accounts has done a really good job. She has seen her role as a sort of holding the fort role, pending the arrival of the new mayor, and she's done that very well. She's a rookie councillor, just got elected last October for the first time, has really grown on the job. She's in her mid-40s, a geoscientist PhD from U of T, has shown lots of brains and empathy on the job. In fact, if she'd been more experienced at City Hall, you could say she'd have been a good option for running in this by-election. But she was adamant from the beginning that she saw her mission as just getting the city through this period of uncertainty until a new mayor could take over. I did talk to her last week, again, at an event in the city. And the timing of these things is like this. By-election day is Monday, June 26, and then only a few days of transition. Only a few days. The new mayor likely to be sworn in, she figures, by the end of that week, presumably June 29 or June 30. The thinking being the new mayor will be able to use July 1st, Canada Day, to open a new chapter for the city at Canada Day celebrations. Anyway, good job, Jennifer McKelvey, and I suspect she'll be one to watch if she decides to stick with politics. Okay, time now for our regular feature, Your Column, My Column, in which JMM and I reminisce about columns we wrote for TVO.org this past week. JMM, what have you got for us?
I wrote about Yasser Naqvi saying that one of the big mistakes that the Liberal Party made when they were in government was the privatization of Hydro One. And, you know, I won't expand on the entire argument here, but I will say that, you know, I think it's an interesting question to ask what, not just what mistakes the party made in the past, but, you know, what kind of rules do you then adopt so that you don't make those mistakes again in the future? Mm-hmm. It's always easy to say, oh, well, gosh, that was a mistake. But then how do you rethink about your own political principles and priorities so that you don't do that again the next time that there is a recession and you are casting about in government looking for money to spend?
Right.
And what about you, Steve?
Well, you know how much I like to write about history, particularly if I've had a front row seat at it. And this past Sunday was the 40th anniversary of the 1983 Progressive Conservative Party of Canada Leadership Convention, which was extremely memorable for a number of reasons. Number one, a delegated convention. So wonderful drama in between ballots as candidates who dropped off the ballot, their delegates have their arms twisted by the surviving candidates to come over to their side. Legendary figures in this convention as well. Joe Clark, a former prime minister, Brian Mulroney, who, as it turns out, would be a future prime minister, John Crosby, David Crombie, Michael Wilson. These are all big names. Peter Pocklington, the owner of the Edmonton Oilers. He was in the race. He did pretty well, actually. And of course, one reason why this convention sort of has an important place in my memory banks is that it was the first one I ever covered. It went four ballots. After the third ballot, there were 22 votes. Out of 3,000 delegates, there were 22 votes separating Joe Clark and Brian Mulroney for the final ballot. I took a lot of pictures back in the day. I put some of them up on the website. I told the story of how the thing unfolded. It's all at TVO.org. And, you know, when we published this thing, I just got so many nostalgic emails and phone calls back from people who said, oh, I was at that one, too, and wasn't that fabulous? And they don't make them like this anymore. So if you're looking for some political nostalgia, that's where it is. While I'm at it, do you remember your first leadership convention that you covered?
It would have been late because I came to provincial politics only in 2013, as we were just talking about earlier.
Did you do Kathleen Wynne at Maple Leaf Gardens?
No, I got to Queen's Park after she had already won. So, gosh, I mean, maybe Patrick Brown?
The PC in 2015.
Yeah.
Okay.
But as we have mentioned, I sometimes tagged along with my dad when he was covering these things. And so I think the first convention I ever actually attended was Jim Flaherty and Ernie Eves competing for the provincial progressive conservative leadership.
2002.
Yeah.
Taking over for Mike Harris.
Yeah. I one of my very intense memories of that was a moving scrum as Flaherty sort of conceded before the final ballot had been announced. And he walked over to the Ernie Eves camp and this mass of reporters. And I think the media actually like knocked over a man in a wheelchair during the process. It was, but, you know, it was very intense and it was, you know, actually kind of alarming when you saw that happen. But it also gave me the, you know, that sense of, oh, this is why people do this job, because that energy is very addictive.
It is. Yep. Well, that is the On Poly podcast for this June 13th, 2023. Please remember, check out our newsletters. You can always subscribe at tvo.org/newsletters. This week, JMM and I riff on about an extraordinary new museum that's just opened in Toronto that was so overpowering. Well, I've got to tell you, I've seen Premier Doug Ford looking grim and overcome when bad things have happened in the past during his time in office, but I don't think I've ever seen him look so grim and overcome. He toured the new Toronto Holocaust Museum at Bathurst and Sheppard in North York, and well, I can just tell you, it had a profound. It looked like it had a profound impact on the premier, and certainly his speech reflected that at the opening. John Michael and I talk about the significance of having this resource in our province, and why we think every school-aged kid should visit this as soon as possible.
Also, make sure to follow our show on Apple Podcasts so that you get notified each time a new episode is available. And if you already follow our show, help a friend follow the show too.
Any feedback you've got, we're happy to hear it, good, bad, or indifferent. Write us an email at onpolitics@tvo.org.
Here's an Apple Podcast review from listener Simon, who commandeered his wife and son's phones to write us not one but two reviews. Now, that is dedication. He writes, "This is my favorite political podcast, thanks to the entertaining, personable hosts and the variety of political topics they cover. Well done, Steve and John Michael."
I wonder which one of us is entertaining and which one of us is personable. I don't know.
Alternating weeks.
Okay, I'll go for that.
This week's episode was produced and edited by Matthew O'Mara. Our managing editor is Shahyar Tajvidi.
Production support from Carla Lucetta and Jonathan Hallowell. Until next Tuesday, everybody. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, everyone.